It's the Troopany Show with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show, the 100th edition of the Troopany Show since we moved from the old WrestlePod server right up here to SoundCloud and iTunes and being a public wrestling podcast. Now, this week we've had some sad news. We had the loss of the living legend Bruno Sammartino. So to join me today to discuss one of the biggest draws in pro wrestling history is Mr. Marcus Green of Total Wrestling Magazine. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I had to make the 100th edition, you know. Not on the best of notes. Obviously, as you said, we lost a huge legend. But luckily, you know, hopefully we can, you know, pay homage and do him justice on this show today.
Yeah, I hope so too. I mean, Bruno, he isn't really in our era. He was champion before even I was born. You know, he's a wrestler of a different era and it's a different style. But I think it's really important to understand how the WWE works in that way. Even today, you know, someone like Roman Reigns is a prime example of that Bruno Sammartino mold, and certainly the champions that Vince Jr. and Vince Sr. championed were kind of that, not the same, but a very similar kind of ethnic background, strong popular baby faces. What do you think of when you think of Bruno, Marcus?
I mean, really, honestly, when you kind of what, you know, his wrestling compatriots say about him, just, you know, class personified.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You know, no one really has a bad word to say about Bruno. He's a class act. He's a cool, smooth guy. And everyone, heel or face, you know, the fans, the promoters, they all loved Bruno. Bruno was a guy that put a smile on people's faces for years and years and years. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's been such a sense of loss, despite the fact he's really lost from this connection of this particular wrestling generation.
Yeah, and it's weird, you know, just going back doing my research on, you know, the great man that he was, you know, he was an everyman, you know, that seemed like he was out of reach, but very grounded at the same time. You know, because the way he was presented was very much larger than life, obviously, you know, the everything with the wrestling business, but he never felt like completely out of reach. And I think that's, you know, why people loved him so much. Obviously, he had that, you know, that deep connection to his roots, which transcended over here when you look at his run in the Garden, which we'll get into. But, you know, he always felt like, you know, he was the person that everybody, whether they, you know, would normally root for a guy like that or not, could really get behind when you really got down to, you know, to the base of just who he was.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there. He has one hell of a personal story as well. I mean, he was born in Pisapurato, Italy, in the mid-1940s or early 1940s, and he grows up in Italy just as the fascists come to power. And then during the Second World War, his family hide from the Nazis, and his mother has to go down into town and sneak around to get food and supplies for his family. They moved to the United States of America after the Second World War, and they moved to Pittsburgh, already the home of the NFL Steelers, though the Pittsburgh Steelers in the 1940s were like, I think they were the worst, they'd been the worst team in the league for about 20 years by that point.
Yeah, we hadn't gotten to that iron wall.
No. But they were, you know, the Steelers were a downtrodden team. Pittsburgh was kind of a downtrodden town. It was a steel industry town. It was a working class town. Just kind of ideal for a working class family like the Sammartinos to grow. He attends, if I can get this correctly, Schnelly High School, which is in North Oakland in Pittsburgh. And he is one of many famous graduates of that particular high school. Andy Warhol, George Benson, and Billy Cox, who ended up being the bass player for Jimi Hendrix, all went to that school in that time period. I think there was 12 years, a 12-year period where you had Andy Warhol, Bruno Sammartino, and George Benson. These guys kind of like really fueled what art would be over the next 20 years, and they all went to the same high school.
Yeah, that's crazy coincidence. Obviously, those are three, you know, obviously pivotal names. And even more interesting than that, you just talk about that, you know, just how rich of a backstory he has in terms of, you know, overcoming adversity. Just, you know, going back a second, I think, and he talked about this himself, obviously it was a struggle for them, you know, just getting over to this country, but I don't even think he almost made it, because I think he said he came down with some type of fever that almost killed him. And I think he just talked about how much he, you know, really, you know, loved his mother, because you know, at the time, obviously, you talked about it, you know, she was, you know, running for her life, and I think she had already lost two kids, and he, you know, was expected not to make it. And she kind of, she basically, I think she, he said she put leeches on his body to kind of suck that infection out of him with the blood, and kind of had him inhale some fumes, and she basically willed him back to life. And then, you know, to come over here, you know, not knowing a lick of English, and then having to, you know, go to school, and like you said, kind of very much being in that workman's, that life that kind of suited his family. But at the same time, I think when he came over here, he was also very sickly. So just trying to make that transition, you know, and obviously any type of schooling back then, you was going to go through some type of bullying. Specifically, you was different during that time anyway. So, you know, just the, you know, miraculous transition that they had to make in itself was impressive, let alone what he did when he actually got over here.
Yeah, I mean, you look at that, this ends up being not as successful initially as he hoped, because he is bullied, because, you know, just come through a war, he's starving, and, you know, he's been sickly for most of his life because of the situation that he and his family have had to endure. So he gets bullied for his size, because it's, you know, because he does. And then he takes to wrestling as an amateur, and he takes to weightlifting. And in fact, his wrestling coach, whose name I've forgotten, because I've not got it on the sheet with me, but he actually ended up being the head wrestling coach for the University of Pittsburgh team eventually, and was massively successful, one of the most successful school programs in the country. He also becomes a great weightlifter. In 1956, he nearly gets an Olympic berth, and he starts putting that weight on to that Bruno size that we recognize today. And certainly, you look at pictures of him from the late 1950s, it doesn't look an awful lot different from the Bruno of his heyday, does it?
No, not at all. And it's real interesting, you know, I think he kind of got scouted, you know, which is, I don't know if it was before or after he started weightlifting. I think it was after, and that just, you know, talking about the weightlifting, that's just the beginning of the building blocks, talking about, you know, him coming up, I think it was like 85 pounds, and I think in his prime, he was like 270 something.
Yeah.
So for him to kind of use, you know, weightlifting as a, you know, transition, and basically just the motivation of, I never want to be bullied again. I mean, you know, you're talking about basically being bullied to a different country where he had to go through the war, and then to come over here and get it, you know, and to really be able to channel that through, you know, weightlifting, and then get to the point where he set a record with that. And, you know, when you look at his build, you know, that was like a true power build. It wasn't, you know, fictional, outrageous like we may see today, like muscles on top of unnecessary muscle. It was just, you know, and he wasn't the biggest guy, but he was stocky, he was wide, he was, you know, built very well, you know.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, in 59, he ends up with a 565 bench press. 565-pound bench press, back when no one really bench pressed much weight. And he did that by himself. He didn't have any support straps or any help otherwise. He just did it as a natural lift, which is quite remarkable, you know, for a guy of that age and that confidence to have that ability is quite impressive. Now, over a period of time in the late 1950s, he starts doing some strongman feats in around the Pittsburgh area and gets picked up by local news, which I find fascinating, because then the local wrestling promoter, Rudy Miller, begins to take notice of him, and that's where we get this first lick of fame as a pro wrestler. He starts training with a guy called Ace Freeman, who was a Hungarian wrestler who'd come over to the States much like him, and he gets trained in the old school style, hook, shoot, make it believable, you know. And certainly if you look at early videos of Bruno, it's very much like that, isn't it? It's a very basic style.
Yeah, very basic, nothing too flash. I mean, the man, you know, like I said, he was built, and really kind of had everything you need, which is why he kind of just had on tights and boots. I mean, you know, you talk about not having any support when he did that amazing bench press, you know, that kind of, you know, also translated to his wrestling. He kind of just had, you know, his arms, his legs, the rest of his body. He didn't really need much else. And, you know, you kind of look at that style, like you said, it wasn't flashy or anything like that, but the basics, you know, he made effective. And when it came right down to it, he just made everything look good, specifically when he was firing back on the guy. Very much kind of had that brawler style, but he could get down when he needed to. I don't think he was the most technically, you know, proficient guy, but he didn't really need to be. You know, like you said, I think, you know, with his build and his aggressiveness when he needed to turn it up, even though he was a babyface, it kind of made up for everything.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting thing for me as far as, like, territory wrestling politics is concerned. Because he grew up in Pittsburgh, where we said, like, Rudy Miller was the lead booker, he had some ins into the New York Territory. Now, the New York Territory in the 1950s was the hotbed. It was the mecca because New York was still the most populous city in the United States of America, and the Northeast Territory was the most sought-after territory in pro wrestling worldwide. Because you have that many amount of people, it's a cultural center, there is TV there, there is media there. You control New York, you kind of control North America. Now, the one person that was really important to that was a guy called Toots Mont. Now, Toots Mont started as a pro wrestler back in the 1910s, but it wasn't until the 1920s where he really began to gain momentum, and it wasn't as a pro wrestler, it was as a promoter. He partnered up with Billy Sandow and with Ed the Strangler Lewis to form the Goldust Trio, and they redesigned pro wrestling. You know, they were kind of sick of wrestling four-hour matches with no conceivable winner, and they were realizing that houses were down because the matches were getting boring, so they introduced time limits. They introduced movesets of predictable moves. They introduced the finish, the idea a match has to end a certain way to make a creative story. And Toots Mont himself kind of invented about 30%, well, 60% of the wrestling moves you see today. Collar over tie-ups, arm drags, all that stuff, all the basic wrestling stuff that you see every day in matches all the time. He invented all that. You know, he was that important to the wrestling industry. Now, eventually the Goldust Trio broke up, but Toots set his eyes on the New York Territory. That's where he wanted to be. And eventually, after taking over the Philadelphia booking office, he moved in on the New York Territory. Now, that was run by a guy called Jack Curley at the time, and there was an interpromotional war brewing through the Philadelphia office with Toots Mont, trying to connect all the dots of all the promoters in New York to take over the New York office. Unfortunately for Jack Curley, he passed away not realizing that Toots was planning a massive coup against him. Because Toots had managed to line up all the other promoters around the New York area to move in on the New York Territory. He went to Jack Curley's funeral to pay his last respects. And then Jack Curley's sons come over to Toots and say, would you mind taking over the New York Territory? Because we don't know what we're doing.
Oh, wow. I'm surprised this hasn't been made into a film.
Yeah, I think this is actually a good story for a film. You know, Toots Mont in general is a good story for a film. You know, he's a wrestling promoter, he's massively untrustworthy, he's a character, you know, one wrestler complained to him one day, I'm sorry I'm late, boss, I had a flat tire, to which Toots reminded, you should have had a flat tire before you left home. And Toots ends up booker of the New York Territory. He has pretty much the palm of his hand. But it takes him that long to take over New York. By the time he gets to the 1930s, he picks his babyface in Antonio Rocca, and they take over New York. They are a massive, massive draw. That continues through the Second World War. By the time we get to the end of the Second World War, we're starting to get into the TV era. Now, the one place they couldn't go in New York was Madison Square Garden, which is strange when we consider the fact that the Garden is WWF's home territory these days, or sorry, WWE's home territory. You don't do anything in New York without being at the Garden. But Toots had to line up a lot of things to make the Garden deal work. One of the people that he started working with was a guy called Jess McMahon. You may know the name McMahon, being a wrestling fan.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to miss.
The other person he started working with was a former wrestler called Bernie McFadden. And he was a multimillionaire, actually, by that point, and started investing in the wrestling industry. Now, Jess McMahon also worked with a guy called Tex Rickard, who was the founder of the New York Rangers and the person who built the third Madison Square Garden, the famous one. And he didn't like pro wrestling and wouldn't have pro wrestling at the Garden. And when he passed away in 1925, they could have wrestling at the Garden because Jess McMahon and Bernard McFadden actually opened up the territory and opened up Madison Square Garden to pro wrestling. So they developed this identity of the New York office based around ethnic minorities in the main event position. First of all, it was Jim Londis, a Greek, and then it became Antonio Rocca, a Latino who was very, very popular with the Spanish-speaking fans of New York City. So by the time we get to the 1950s, the New York office is based around this concept. And then Buddy Rogers comes along, and Toots is trying to make the New York office more important. So he has Buddy Rogers, a former NWA World Heavyweight Champion. He starts booking with Vince McMahon Sr., Vincent J. McMahon, and he has all this connection of promoters in New York. And they break away from the NWA and form the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, of which Buddy Rogers is the champion. This is when Bruno joins the company, and this is when Bruno has like his place in the wrestling history and time to shine. But Buddy Rogers doesn't work like that. Buddy Rogers is a guy who shuts down competition. He brings in his own guys to work the card. He brings in his own people. He books his own angles, and he books the angles of the guys on his crew, which meant that Bruno was slowly, slowly getting pushed out, and eventually he leaves the WWWF and tries to go to California. Sorry, that was a bit of a mouthful there, Marcus, and I kind of took over, but what do you think of growing up in this era where the big names on the cards are controlling everything? How do you think it was for someone like Bruno, who's trying to break in and trying to get some control on his own destiny?
I mean, you know, first off, like I said, I never get tired of hearing you talk about this stuff. It's like sitting in class. I mean, you know, for Bruno, like I said, I think it was just, you know, even when he, I think, reached the peak of his success, it was just kind of all about, you know, really surviving and getting to a place of some certain level of comfort that he never thought he'd get to. So obviously, I think coming into this and, you know, just like I said, going back through interviews, you know, he constantly said this, he never really had any huge, you know, fantasies what came involved wrestling. It was new for him. You know, it may have been somewhat of a seamless transition when you look at, you know, the athletics and the things involved with being a wrestler coming off his bodybuilder, you know, background. But he was just a simple guy, you know, just trying to make it and put his family in a position, you know, that they obviously never would have gotten to otherwise. So I think for him, he was just trying to do the right thing. I mean, he was billed as a baby face. Naturally, you know, coming out of that war and everything, you talk about building up the minorities, you know, and people of that ilk in that New York area. Of course, he was going to be hot. I mean, it's a natural born hero story. But I think somebody like Bruno, who really is trying to, and he was no pushover, but I think when you had that many powers that be kind of, you know, working out of your favor, and I don't really think he was huge into politics either. I could be wrong, but I don't really think he was kind of, you know, doesn't seem like a guy who was really big into that either. It probably was definitely difficult, but I think, you know, this, you know, JR says this, and many, you know, people through history, cream always rises to the top, and I think, you know, that's something you can definitely liken to his story, even when he, even when powers that be, like I said, were working against him.
Yeah, it intrigues me. Well, I mean, after this, Bruno ends up leaving the territory. He's going to go work for Roy Scheider in California, the WWA territory, another outlaw promotion outside of the NWA. Though they have good relationships with the NWA. Yeah, so he's going to go to work for Roy Scheider, but it turns out that he's actually booked in a show in Chicago and booked in a show in Baltimore, and which he obviously misses because no one told him. Now, for years, he blames Jess McMahon and Toots Monk for booking him on these shows, so they kind of ruined his run in California. And eventually, he can't go to California because California uphold, the State Athletic Commission uphold the rulings in Chicago and in Maryland, and therefore, he's stuck. He ends up being a labourer for a while, but eventually, he moves to the Canadian territory of Toronto and Frank Tunney's Toronto promotion, where he makes himself a massive star because there's a big Italian population in Toronto and Bruno speaks fluent Italian. So that's where he actually ends up making his first run as a major main event star. He also tags up with Whipper Billy Watson, the all-time Toronto draw. What do you think of this, Marcus? How does this young man from Italy, who's had so many setbacks, keep coming back to the wrestling industry?
Well, like I said, I think it's, you know, true to form, cream always rises to the top. But I think just hearing you go through, you know, talk about all this stuff. It's amazing to me how so many of these themes are even prevalent in the, you know, wrestling world in which we view today, like the maniacal promoters, you know, kind of banding together and putting certain guys over and holding certain guys back, or, you know, obviously having star power in Bruno, but not necessarily recognizing that potential. And somebody like a Bruno being smart enough to go to other territories, and obviously sometimes when you get a door slammed in your face, a window opens. So you go to those other territories like a Toronto, and obviously that's a huge, you know, some of the Italian population, obviously that's his first language. You know, like I said, the cream rise to the top, that was a perfect, you know, high bid for him. And of course, as we see today, a lot of times when a premier talent gets mistreated, oftentimes they have to go away, get popular, and then return even hotter.
He becomes a hot property in Toronto, and like you said, you have to, how can you miss me if I never leave? You know, is one of Jim Cornette's favorite phrases, but he's right, you know. Going to Toronto, he becomes this massive star and this massive draw. And down in New York, Toots Martin and Vince McMahon Jr. are starting to have problems with Buddy Rogers, who has, as we've seen in million times in the past, when you give your lead star too much power, all sorts of things go wrong, don't they? So Buddy Rogers is starting to be problematic in New York. They can see the potential that Bruno has in Toronto. So they ask him to come back down, and Bruno refuses, partly because of the previous stuff that had gone on, but partly because he doesn't want to leave Frank Tunney in the lurch. Now, Frank Tunney does let him go in the end, but he makes sure that he always has 2 days a month for Frank Tunney in his schedule, because he wants to pay back to the person that gave him the break in the first place and believed in him. And then he goes on to win the WWF Heavyweight Championship at the first attempt, beating Buddy Rogers in 49 seconds. That's quite a turnaround, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, kind of look at it, just framing it from just a wrestling fan's perspective, it almost seems like that whole thing is one big match. And, you know, obviously Bruno in this situation was the underdog. You know, you got the maniacal managers, and then obviously Buddy Rogers is the one that they're managing. And then he puts, you know, Bruno down for, all three of them put Bruno down for a while. He goes away and then comes back even hotter. And then when he comes back, it's kind of like that, you know, that babyface kick out. And then now he gets on top. So, I mean, you know, that's great. And then looking at the other perspective, his loyalty, to Toronto and the promoter there, you know, kind of reminds me of what we get today in a way when you have guys who go away, like I said, to indies and they get really hot and then they come back to these main promotions. And, they very much want to keep, you know, the agreements they had with these promotions before they fully transfer back into these huge promotions, because you want to have that credibility, you know, in the wrestling business of being somebody who, you know, is a man of their word and, you know, agrees to the things that they gave their word on. So, you know, it's like I said, these things are very much kind of like how we get the performances. It's all one big wheel, and it always comes back around. So it's cool to see in this story, and it's even cooler. And like I said, Bruno was no dummy by any stretch of the imagination. He very much understood the potential of what it meant to be able to go back, even if it was working for guys who seemingly kind of screwed him over. But he also kept that loyalty to, you know, the guy that got him hot, you know, seemingly when he kind of fell off. So, you know, it's great. And again, it just speaks to the man that Bruno was.
Yeah, I mean, like, Toots always thought he'd be a star. He always thought he was a main event quality player from the moment he first set eyes on him. Whereas Vince just thought he would be like a mid-card guy who'd be around for a couple of years and then move on. So, you know, that was always interest me. As Vince McMahon Jr. grew as a promoter, he realized the value that Bruno had. And Bruno always realized the value that he had as well. He was always cutting deals that were, you know, suited to his particular status. Now, he has a 7-year run with the WWF Heavyweight Championship. And to be honest with you, it doesn't get as much play as his second run with the title, which we'll talk about shortly, but I think that's mainly down to the fact there just wasn't video around of what he did. The only match I can find of his first run when I was watching through matches this week was his championship loss to Ivan Koloff in 1971. What are your thoughts on that first run, and what are your thoughts on Bruno in this particular time period?
I mean, obviously, you know, that first one, just, you know, this is a completely different era, you know, obviously, from what we get today. We often get a lot of hot potato things today, and sadly enough, a lot of forgetful title reigns. But, you know, with Bruno, that first one was incredible. And you talk about being in an era where they didn't necessarily have TV. You talk about guys getting money out of the gate and him becoming, you know, what everybody wants to be in the wrestling business, which is, you know, somebody who's truly over. You know, because at that point, you literally putting, you know, butts in seats. And that was also during the time, and we'll get to it when we talk about transitioning to TV. You know, it was a huge thing to be able to see these guys in person. So those live events and everything, you know, meant the world. I think, you know, that's what kind of still holds true today with live events, is just a certain element that you just don't get even when you're watching it on TV. As opposed to a live event, because for some reason it's just a different atmosphere. So for Bruno to be able to do what he did at a time where you literally got injured and kept going, you know, no matter the severity, obviously, you know, we're paying close attention to health issues now, but, you know, back then it was kind of go on for him to be his champion as long as he was, you know, really, you know, speaks to that perseverance and that real just gutsy gold type of, you know, grit that he had. You know, it's incredible. Like you said, couldn't find a lot on that first run, but that doesn't, you know, detract from what he did. It's just incredible looking at, you know, the transition, like you said, from, you know, obviously, you're talking about the guy that didn't want to deal with wrestling to it, kind of growing, because obviously sports, football, basketball, that stuff was, you know, the foundation, but introducing wrestling to this, you know, this audience had to be something amazing to them, which is why you got the numbers that you did. And then you bring that, you know, those different ethnic groups together, obviously put Bruno in the center of that, that's going to attract even more people. And then you transition into being able to put it in a format to where people can watch it from home. It's also interesting watching the evolution of this man while we're watching the evolution of the business as well.
Yeah, I mean, you that's a really interesting point, because, like, you know, TV industry is working now. TV is making everything look, you know, bigger. There's more eyes on the product. There's more attention to what's going on in the product. But, I mean, also for me, it's like, environment dictates behavior. WWF ran in old boxing rings. The fans were super hot for everything you did, so you didn't have to work that hard. One of the things that, like, propels this 7-year run is because Bruno can look after his body. You know, he's not doing flying head scissors and taking big bumps every night. He never did, but no one else did either. You know, you look back at those matches in that particular time period in the late 60s, everyone's taking their time. Everyone's getting as much effort out of everything they do. You know, you watch Bruno put an armbar on superstar Billy Graham and the place erupts. And it's just an armbar. And that's no matter where they are in the WWF territory. It's not just the garden. It's everywhere. The fans were so hot for this product and the wrestlers were so beloved or hated. It's really a different era altogether.
Yeah, it's a big one. Also, you know, like I said, it's almost like being shell-shocked going back and watching some of this stuff, because everything that very much gets brushed to the side or kind of, you know, goes through the motions for a young wrestling fan today, it meant so much back then. Like, just a simple Irish whip into the corner, you know, it was damn near a finisher, depending on who did it. So, you know, a crossbody off the top was huge. You know, that was kind of the moment of the match. And you talk about going to the top and missing, that could potentially cost a guy the match, because you can legitimately pin a guy off that and win the match. But now that's just something, you know, that you obviously, you know, the guy's going to kick out of. So between that, the evolution of the business, and just looking at Bruno's climb, it really is, you know, a lot of, you know, call it a perfect storm, a lot of stuff coming together. And it's crazy because, like you said, this was also going back to, you know, those that trio that you mentioned earlier. We're also watching the development of the wrestling maneuvers itself.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, back then something, you know, really huge was, you know, fly across body off the top. But Bruno, you know, kept it simple, like you said, the arm drags, you know, simple holds and stuff of that elk. And of course, something big for Bruno was a big back body drop. I think that was a trademark for him. So it's really cool just seeing things, like I said, that small nowadays matter so much back then.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at how the business developed along those lines, I mean, the stuff that Bruno was doing in his second run wasn't, you know, wilder, but it was just more intense. He learned how to plot his intensity, and he, because by this point, he was booking his own angles. You know, he was booking his own matches. He was road agent for his own matches. He booked the angles. He picked the opponents. And he worked with Vincent J. McMahon in a way that was much more symbiotic than any wrestler would have today. You know, today, even main eventers don't really have a massive amount of input into what's going on with their championship reign. But back then, everything that Bruno did was what Bruno wanted to do with some help from Vince McMahon. And Vince McMahon trusted him to do the job.
Yeah, and I think obviously, I think that has a lot to. I mean, I think it's a lot of factors. But obviously, when you're selling out the gun as much as he did,
180 times,
and also, a night, and you know, you also Bruno, like I said, through all this, he was just a stand-up guy. You know, if he gave you his word, that's what he stood on. And you know, I think, you know, watching Bruno, like you said, he, you know, Vince kind of knew, you know, he could always be a draw. But I think getting to watch him come into that, and I think through all that, still remaining a very much respectable class act that he was, I think that, you know, just helped, and the collaborative effort that, you know, we got back then. Obviously, we don't see it, like you said, as much now, unless you're somebody who just can, you know, like putting your hands on people, just making a muck of stuff. But, you know, I think somebody like Bruno makes it very easy, you know, to kind of work with.
I mean, that's the thing with Bruno. He was just so solid at everything he did. You know, he wasn't spectacular. He was solid, and I think that's an important lesson to learn from modern wrestlers. Now, 1971, he drops the title to Ivan Koloff in a match in the Madison Square Garden, which was so unexpected that when Koloff won the championship, the place went dead silent, and you could hear a pin drop. Which is possibly one of the worst examples of quiet heat you want to hear, because that means they're going to riot sometime soon. In fact, when Lou Albano got his charge into a taxi cab on the way home, 50 people came to overturn the taxi.
that's crazy. And that just also goes to show you, like I said, just looking at this generation, just how much the curtain has been, shows you just how much the curtain has been pulled back now.
Yeah.
Because now, you will get that for a fan to get likes or followers on Twitter or get it on YouTube or something. But that was, like, you were legitimately in danger at a lot of times back then, because this meant everything to them, and there was no, you know, question about the believability of things. You got invested in what was given to you, and you responded in kind. And, you know, it's always almost cringeworthy and almost appreciated hearing those stories, because, you know, that was, you know, the earliest developments of the art, and kind of what you still want to see today. Obviously not to that extreme, but you still want to keep a certain level of believability. But, you know, as things evolve, we have to kind of, you know, change them. But that's really, you know, speaks to that era, and just, you know, hopefully nothing could have almost happened to Bruno, but I don't think it could, because, like you said, he was the, you know, baby face to the gods almost.
Yeah.
But, that's interesting. Turning over a cab, that's crazy.
I mean, at this particular point, I mean, Koloff was one of the top heels in the territory. He'd been there for quite some time. And Bruno wanted a rest. He was tight shut out. Like, Koloff said in non-shoot interviews and kayfabe interviews, he looked tired. He'd been doing this for 7 years in rock-hard boxing rings. And even if you have a softer style where you don't have to work so hard, it's still going to take your toll on the body.
Yeah, and I think coming from somebody of a background like Bruno with that, you know, that weightlifting, and just as pure as he did it, he's very much coming into that knowing full well of, you know, being able to do what he did. You very much have to be aware of your body and all certain aspects. And I think, you know, doing that for as long as he did in the boxing ring, you very much become aware of, you know, when you need to slow down and when your body's talking to you. So again, that's just his, you know, being smart coming into play, and, you know, not necessarily what we got in later years where guys just refused to kind of move over off that top spot. Bruno, like I said, he was just appreciative of everything he did. So, you know, when it came to, you know, dropping off the belt, I think, you know, his longevity was far more important, because at that point, you know, he had achieved a lot of, obviously, you know, absolutely beloved by the fans, and I think gotten to a point where he was able to put his family in a position, like I said before, that they could have never even dreamed of. So I think it was easier for a guy like him to make that decision when, you know, he didn't become obsessed with himself and everything he achieved.
So, moving forward then, he then spends a period of time on the road wrestling in Japan for Giant Baba, and sometimes for Antonio Inoki, and falling out with him. And then he wrestles all over the United States of America over the next 3 years, going to places like Memphis and St. Louis. He wrestles Harley Race to an hour-long draw. He does things that he wants to do as a wrestler rather than being on the clock. eventually, Vince McMahon, who's eventually taken over the New York territory and pushed Toots Month out, he wants him back. He's had a run with Pedro Morales, which was successful, but Pedro isn't Bruno, and he wants to cement his legacy in the New York City area and really have a major draw. Now, Bruno's not interested at this particular point, and the only way that Vince and Jay McMahon gets him to come back to work for the WWF is to give him a percentage of gate receipts, which is an unheard of deal, and he comes back and takes the championship in 1974. Marcus, was this the right decision, do you think? I mean, financially, of course, it would be in the end, but, you know, it kind of sways to Bruno's sense of worth again, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, on both sides, it just seems like small business. I mean, you know, at every level of this story, you know, Bruno is leveling up both, you know, inside and outside of the ring. Obviously, you know, knowing how business works, you know, working from that transition to the Toot and then, you know, McMahon at the same time, and now just Vince. You know, obviously there's an established relationship between them. They both know what they bring to the table. You know, Bruno is absolutely beloved, like I said, quick draw. And for Bruno, like you said, he kind of went around and traveled, as a lot of wrestlers do. And obviously his body is not what it used to be. And obviously, you know, going from a boxing ring to Japan, you know, that has to be, you know, absolute something to endure for, you know, physically. So, you know, I just think it was a small move. He's like, look, if I'm going to go through this again, it has to be worth it. You know, he wasn't a greedy guy, but he certainly, you know, by the time he got to that point, you know, he certainly wasn't no guy who didn't know what he was worth. Specifically, when you're packing out Madison Square Garden, you know, from the magazines to the press, the man became a worldwide sensation. So, you know, I just think it was a small business move. And I don't think he even would have made it if he didn't think he could, you know, physically, you know, take the toll. You know, and this was going into, what, his second reign?
Yeah, it's his second reign, which is 3 years long.
As champion, which obviously didn't last long as his first, but still, I mean, like you said, again, it speaks to the guy he was.
Yeah, I mean, this second reign is probably the more famous because it has the bigger matches of the two. You know, even though his first reign was longer, because there's less videotape around, you can't find as much of that stuff on the network. And to be honest with you, I'm not even sure WWE owned the rights to it. You know, the one version I found of his match with Koloff was a match which had which was on shot on film and was from a completely different angle where you shoot the garden from, but you could see the match. So, you know, and it definitely wasn't a WWF film. So, you know, as that stuff was down to the local TV companies in New York that they were working with. But by the time you get to the 70s, you start to see the birth of closed circuit and cable television. There's the Madison Square Garden network that happens in the 80s. You know, there is more stuff to be recorded for. And that's really where WWF starts to really build some momentum by the big matches at Shea Stadium. And the first big match they have at Shea is Pedro Morales defending the WWF Championship against Bruno Sammartino after they fall out in a tag match. And going to the Shea became the era's equivalent of WrestleMania. Shea Stadium, the home of the New York Mets at the time. And, you know, they were filling these arenas, which is kind of a precursor to what Vince Jr. wanted to do. What did you think of this, Marcus?
Yeah, again, it's just amazing to see just the evolution. You know, we talk about this great, you know, legend and Bruno, but just looking at, you know, the parallel between his story and just the growth of the business. You talk about them going from Madison Square Garden, which is legendary and prominent, but also knowing the fact that, you know, if we're doing this this many times a year with this guy, and we can get somebody who can be of equal strength, you know, on the bad side, we can take this to a bigger stage. And you know, put on some even, you know, more spectacular, and then, you know, generationally just see that trickle down of Vince's son. And for him, you know, for as many things as can be said about Vince, and there are plenty, Vince Jr. obviously, for him to take the idea and even evolve that to another level and really change, you know, the business and set of standards is just impeccable. But we wouldn't have gotten to the point we got today without also Vince Cena and a guy like Bruno, you know, setting that standard.
Yeah, exactly. That's where things really become glued together. And that a symbiotic idea of a major main event draw and the promoter, which we see again in Hulk Hogan and Hulk Hogan and Vince McMahon, and Steve Austin and Vince McMahon, and to an extent John Cena, and to an extent Roman Reigns. But this is certainly the blueprint for that. He sees what his dad's done with Bruno and Pedro Morales, and you know, that's where this blueprint comes from. I think a lot of the interest that Vince has in people like The Rock as an ethnic minority within the company being promoted to the main event is very much to do with Toot Mont's idea of what pro wrestling should be. Appeal to a minority audience and the rest of the audience will come with you.
Yeah, and again, we look at somebody's story like The Rock, not obviously directly parallel with Bruno, but you know, The Rock did not come from, you know, rich beginnings, you know, very, you know, humble, you know, anybody that loves, you know, knows anything about The Rock, you know, he very much had to grind, you know, to get where he was, and definitely gone through hardships, and became one of the most recognizable guys and most popular guys in all of pro wrestling. You know, you talk about, you know, listing those names. Even if you're not a wrestling fan, you know about Bruno, you know about Hogan, you know about Austin, and you definitely know about The Rock, certainly these days. So, it's not a lot of guys who can transcend, you know, the business in that sense. But, you know, these guys, and I think we could do a completely separate show one day on just, you know, the certain intangible similarities and contrasts of what, you know, just these guys had that really made them push through that ceiling of, he's just a wrestler, you know, that guy. These guys are far more than that, and what they did for the business, you know, can't be forgotten. It's really great, though, seeing that transition from Bruno all the way to a guy like Roman Reigns, and just seeing, you know, that effect, and even going to Vince Jr., just seeing that, you know, that, I guess, that picture in his mind of his dad, Bruno, that seemingly has not changed. Obviously, the players have, but that mold in itself, obviously, you know, we've never seen another Bruno again, you know, just because he was just such a, you know, once-in-a-lifetime type of guy. But very much a lot of attempts to repeat that in some form.
Yeah, definitely, you know. And as we move through the late 1970s, he has money feuds with people like Ivan Koloff, as you'd expect, rematches. He has money feuds with other heels of that particular era. And noticeably, a young man called Stan the Lariat Hansen comes up to New York from the Texas Territory, breaks into the New York Territory at Sammartino's request, and then accidentally breaks Bruno's neck with a botched body slam on a TV taping. But it led to one of the biggest payoff runs for any wrestler in WWF history, as him and Bruno fill Shea Stadium again, and then the Garden in a cage, and then take that cage match all around the loop. You know, this was a breakthrough moment for Stan Hansen, who was a young wrestler who'd just come out of training school. He'd only been wrestling for a couple of years, but it made Hansen as this crippler, this killer. And funnily enough, he felt awful about it, as you imagine he would, because he's just dropped the moneymaker for the entire New York Territory on his head. But Bruno said to him, "Don't worry about it, it's wrestling. It's what we got into. It's just what we do." And, you know, so great was his charisma as a gentleman, all of the heels in the New York office treated Stan with respect, even though he had screwed up big time, but they never mentioned anything to his face, because that's not the way things were done. You know, these days that kind of thing would have created a Twitter war between three different wrestlers from 14 different companies. But back then, Bruno said, "Don't worry about it, it's what we do for a living. I can't go into a wrestling match and expect not to get hurt." And everybody else followed suit in that particular instance. And they went on and made a ton of money, which is another reason to, you know, be nice to each other.
Yeah, that's crazy. And, today, because everything just has to be more overblown and it needs to be in this particular society we live in, that's a lot of times more obsessed with social media than we are, you know, our society in general, it seems. You know, going back, you know, to that was, you know, it seems like a big deal, but, you know, in the confines of the good and evil foundation of wrestling, it's almost a no-brainer to kind of play off something like, you know, legitimately what happened to Bruno, unfortunately. You know, obviously any wrestler worth their salt would not want, you know, is always protective of himself and his partner. But to play off that and to skyrocket that into, you know, a feud that would obviously make Stan, you know, more of a heel, and, you know, off the, you know, babyface Bruno and coming back off that injury and taking it to a steel cage match to kind of just show how, you know, this feud is elevated. I mean, that's just, again, brilliant business, and almost in a form of what we see today, obviously to a lesser extent, what, you know, what we saw with, you know, Eddie Edwards and Sammy Callahan.
Yeah.
You take a real life situation and you turn it into the confines of good and evil wrestling to benefit, you know, both babyface and the heel. Obviously those two guys are those Hanson and Martino, but, you know, those simple business fundamentals and you know, just classic wrestling themes, you know, they never get old. Like you always say, sometimes predictable isn't always bad, you know. So, you know, like I said, this stuff always just comes full circle.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, it was one of those periods of time where there was just so much money going on in the New York office that it was a momentum killer, but they turned it into a positive. You know, it was a couple of months of dead air there for the championship, but there was other things going on within the company. They could keep the momentum going, and then they could go back to Shane.
Yeah, and real quick, it's almost, I was kind of brilliant because, you know, obviously Stan Hansen is known for that, you know, I'm sorry, I killed you clothesline type of brutal it was. Didn't mean to take your head off type of thing, but you that's brilliantly plays into that. I mean, because you accidentally dropping the man on his neck, and we all know the part about it at the clothesline target. So, you know, that's brilliant. That's a seamless transition, really. I mean, obviously, you know, not for poor Martino's neck, because, you know, breaking the neck, you know, I don't know if you ever fully recover from something that traumatic, you know, in terms of, you know, where it is on your body. But that really works so well for something like that, and for those two guys to be able to kind of, you know, really work well. And obviously, a lot of that has to do with Bruno, like you said, being a gentleman and knowing good business when he sees it. And again, that just speaks to that era, and specifically those two guys, even with Hanson, who still to this day speaks highly of.
Yes, he does, very much so. And then eventually, Bruno loses the championship to superstar Billy Graham. Again, he's worn out, he's had enough, and he decides to call it a day as a full-time pro wrestler. He does, in 1980, have a big money feud with Larry Zbysko, and he was obviously one of Larry Zbysko's mentors as Larry came from Pittsburgh. Larry used to peek through his hedges and try and catch sight of him because he wanted to become a pro wrestler. And eventually one day, Bruno talked to him, got him lined up as a pro wrestler in the mid-1970s, and Larry went on to be his protege, and they quite often openly talked about it on WWF television. And that led to another match when Larry turned on Bruno and was a big money draw at the Ali Antonio Inoki close circuit fight, which they showed at Shea Stadium. But the actual draw for that particular show was Larry Zbysko versus Bruno Sammartino in a cage, because that was the money match for the New York territory.
Yeah, just being, you know, a fan of movies and stuff, it's kind of almost really interesting and intriguing just how much, you know, you can almost compare Bruno's story to Rocky's story in a way.
Yeah.
You talk about that storyline, because obviously, you know, I think they were calling, you know, Bruno, you know, trying to live a legend. I think he obviously grew into that. As he kept going through those, you know, magnificent reigns, that was never nothing he kind of put on himself or set out to do. But, you know, what he was doing, I mean, it personified that moniker. But then you look at that feud he had, you know, those classic feuds he had, it's kind of, you know, initially when he won the title, it was kind of like getting off Apollo. When you look at Kozlov. Yeah. And then now with this being betrayed by the guy he was managing, kind of harkens back to what you saw with that was Rocky V. so, you know, kind of having the school your student, and you know, I taught you everything you know, not everything I know, type of deal. So that's really cool. And again, it's also cool seeing, you know, a performer now going through a lot of Ric Flair's later years, just seeing a guy that really knows when it's time to hang it up and hangs it up on his own accord. So that's again, you know, kudos to Bruno, and even better that he got that last run, because I mean, like a Rocky, it's very easy, you know, to get a guy over. Like, how could you screw over Rocky? How could you screw over Bruno? Like, who has this guy ever done anything to? So that's just simple.
Yeah, yeah, it was. I mean, then in 1980, he finally retires from full-time in-ring competition, does one more tour of Japan for Giant Baba, one of his best friends in wrestling. He bought Giant Baba a car because he saw Giant Baba going to get out of a small Toyota, which was not the most comfortable of driving experiences. So when he went home, he was selling his Cadillac. So instead of selling it, he shipped it up and sent it to Giant Baba as a present. And the next time he was in Japan, Baba had a driver and he was being driven around in the back of his Cadillac. How cool was that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But then Bruno kind of goes into semi-retirement, wrestles when he wants to, and eventually Vince McMahon Jr. wants him back to be part of the WrestleMania era. And he does come back after he has sued the WWF because one of their old accountants and one of their old bookers, I think it was Salvadi, who was also a jobber for them in the 1960s, pointed out that actually Vince McMahon Sr. had never actually fully paid up those gate receipts he promised Bruno in the 1970s, and he sued the WWF. Vince McMahon Jr. actually settled out of court, and I think it was somewhere stated that Bruno got paid somewhere in the region of $150,000 for 19 days work if he came back to the World Wrestling Federation. Yeah, interesting that. Anyway, he comes back, and part of the deal was he wanted a place for his son David Sammartino, who ends up wrestling at WrestleMania 1, and he would come back on commentary. He also does some big matches. He had a big feud with Randy Savage in the late 1980s as well. It was a good time for Bruno as far as wrapping up his career at his own pace and doing matches when he wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't think this whole journey was anything Bruno ever envisioned, but I think once you get into something like that and, you know, just the way you can kind of just, you know, get enveloped and never that Bruno was ever subject to his own hype, but it's very hard to, you know, be involved with something like that, fall in love, you know, with the business of pro wrestling and kind of just kind of ease on out. Obviously, you know, you want to do business to take care of your finances and everything and settle, but, you know, he always, I think, came back for the fans and just, I don't think you ever get tired of something you love or something you're good at. And, you know, so for him to be able to come back, you know, the times that he did and have those top feuds, you know, again, just spoke to his popularity and, you know, spoke to the fact of, you know, you got to give some kudos to McMahon, knowing where to put him, knowing who to put him up against. And, again, this was a rare era where, you know, somebody like Bruno was calling his own shot. So, you know, again, just good business and Bruno doing it while he still could.
Exactly. That's the key thing, I think. That's the key thing I remember. Now, Bruno kind of fell off the wrestling radar for a while, but, you know, he was critical of the WWE in the 1990s, specifically in the Attitude Era, which precluded him really from ever joining the WWE Hall of Fame, which he didn't really want to do whilst the WWE was in this mode of gratuitous sex and violence. By the time we get around to the 2010s, Triple H is kind of in charge of talent relations, and he starts contacting Bruno, and eventually he's allowed into the WWE Hall of Fame, and does accept a deal to join the Hall of Fame. Reportedly got very well paid, and probably more than the $5,000 standard fee that most people get, because without him, the WWE Hall of Fame doesn't really mean an awful lot. Bruno is the WWE's greatest champion. He held the belt longer than anybody else, he held the belt with more successful title defenses than anybody else, and he made more money than anybody else, given relative time period to the amount of people that were in the territory at the time. Now the territory's worldwide, but back when it was just the New York and the Northeast, that really did mean an awful lot. They were making a lot of money, and there's an argument to say he was more successful than Hogan and more successful than Steve Austin because of the amount of money and time they spent on promotion when, you know, it was a really different era. How would Bruno have done in the modern day? And I think he'd have done very well. But, yeah, what do you think of this, Marcus? What do you think of him trying to protect his legacy?
Well, I think it's only fair. I mean, I think, you know, when you come from, you know, is the beginnings that Bruno did, and then you get off into this and you finally able to truly make something of yourself and provide for the family the way he did and go through what he did to do so, you know, you very much want to be, you know, protective of that. And that's just him being a class act and a stand-up guy, knowing that, you know, everything that he went through, he did it, you know, on his own two feet as a man and did it his way. and, you know, not only just, you know, loving the fans, but just growing to love the business. And when you love something like that, you don't want to see it tarnished or tainted, specifically coming from a background of weightlifting where, you know, credibility is everything. So, you know, just coming from that mindset alone, you know, being a true power lifter, you know, these guys, cheating, you know, to get across the finish line and to basically feed off the crumbs of which the cake that he, you know, baked in a way. It just taints stuff. And when you want to see guys kind of carry on that greatness, you want to see them do it legitimate and straight up. Because, you know, somebody like Bruno would hope to inspire somebody, you know, a kid, you know, could look at him and then maybe not necessarily have the same background, but, you know, go through the, you know, the being small and being bullied in a way and being able to overcome your circumstances. He wouldn't want somebody like that to take the easy way out, which is, you know, kind of juicing up. So, you know, again, it just keeps coming back with this. Bruno's a class act, and, you know, he stood his ground when it came to WWE. And I think, as I said numerous of times before his induction, it took a hell of a lot of convincing for Triple H, to finally, you know, bring him on board. And kudos to him. A lot could be said about Triple H as well, but kudos to him for reaching out and realizing that, you know, we need to have a guy like Bruno for this business, not just to thank him for everything that he did, but for to legitimize what we're trying to do. You can't mention anything of relevance in wrestling, specifically in WWE, and not talk about Bruno when he set the standard, the slab in which they stand on today. So
I couldn't agree more, and I think that's probably the best note to leave Bruno on. He passed away this week. He was the greatest WWF heavyweight champion of all time. He held the belt for 10 years. He drew more money than anybody else. He had more friends than anybody else. And not many people say bad stuff about him. Bruno was Bruno. The Garden was the Garden. And he sold it out 180 times. And he is the rock on which the WWE is built.
Yes, he is.
I'd like to thank my guest for today, Mr. Marcus Green of Total Wrestling Magazine. I appreciate your time, sir.
No, man, thank you. Always a pleasure. Like I said, it was great sitting in class once again on the True Penny Tree and getting to talk about a great man. Sad to lose him, but, you know, thankful for everything that he did.
Indeed, and we will miss Bruno very, very much. Now, this is the 100th edition of the True Penny Show on SoundCloud, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts from, so I'd like to thank a few people. Firstly, Mr. Ben Spindler, without whom I would not have a show, because he's the person that asked me to do it in the first place. You can find him at Tick Holloway on Twitter. I'd like to thank Ollie Davis of WrestleTalk TV. You can find him at Ollie Davis, who helped us set up on our own and give us so much promotion and encouragement when we left WrestleTalk. I'd like to thank Mr. Marcus Green of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, for all the help he's put into this show, sir.
Oh, man, 100% my pleasure, man.
I would also like to thank Gavin Duenis, who's been on the show before. I'd like to thank all our regular contributors. Cy Heath at Butlins Club on Twitter. Alex Watt at AlexWatt187 on Twitter. Alex Edwards, Alex_Edwards_ on Twitter. And of course, Miss Chelsea Spolin, Shoulders_Up, and at Chelsea Comics on Twitter. These guys are some of our best friends, and I absolutely love and adore podcasting with them and talking wrestling with them every week on the True Penny Show. It's absolutely awesome, and I want to thank you all very much for being a huge part of my life. And the fact that I get for an hour a week to chat with my mates about wrestling is something that I will always cherish. The show has had ups and downs and sideways and done different things, and I'm glad to hear that people are still listening to us after all this time. So thank you very much for listening to us, and we hope you keep sticking with us for another 100 episodes. If you want to talk to us, find us on all of those Twitter handles that I just mentioned, but you can also find us the True Penny Show Twitter at True Penny Show. You can find us on Facebook, True Penny Show, or The True Penny Show, and you can find us on Patreon. Please subscribe and help us out, because it helps keep the show free forever for everyone, which is really what we're after. Thank you very much for listening today. Thank you for listening to us always. Take care, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye.